Welcome to another episode of Sex and Horror Podcast with authors Dicey Grinner and Chantel Renee. Tonight we are excited to have Damon Manx on with us.
Yay! Woo!
Yay! Welcome!
How's it going?
Going well.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so happy to have you on here. We are in Houston, and I'm going to tell you what, it was 90 degrees. Hot, smoking, beautiful, though, sunny. And suddenly it started hailing over here, just coming down really hard. The sky got dark. I thought the lightning was going to come through the ceiling, and my power went out.
Houston. Perfect timing.
Yeah. Where are you, Damon?
I'm in New Jersey, just outside of the Lincoln Tunnel, so not far from Manhattan. And I've been wearing my leather jacket for the last... 9 months because it's still kind of chilly in the morning when I go out to walk the dog. So I just went out now just to walk around the house. It's a little brisk here. So
wow.
Yeah. Yes.
That is so opposite from here. We had about 15 minutes of that. It was going down and then it just stopped and then the sand came back out and it was nice and steaming hot again.
Yep. That's Houston though. You don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes.
That's it. You could be on one side of the street, it'll be raining. On the next side of the street, you got sunny skies, right?
Exactly. Have you been to Houston?
I've been through Houston, yeah. I've definitely been through Texas on a little bit of a tour and definitely stopped in Houston for like a little brief stint.
A hot minute, okay.
He's like, it's hot, I ain't fucking staying in this place long.
I found most of Texas to be really incredibly hot, but man, I love the tacos. So I'm going to keep coming back to Texas, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, pretty much.
Last time I was there, I found Torchy's tacos.
And Yeah, a lot of people love that.
Yeah, I love that.
Good place.
So a little bit about Damon. He is an author of speculative horror fiction, and he's the owner of Last Waltz Publishing. So for those who don't know, what is speculative fiction or speculative horror fiction?
Picture an episode of The Twilight Zone, and that's pretty much what your speculative fiction is. Possibilities that are outside possibly our world or maybe taking place in alternate versions of our own world. Taking it out of speculation, this is a possibility. Maybe it's not our possibility, but it's a possible scenario. It's really a wide open genre. I kind of write my stories as if this could work on the Twilight Zone, I think I got a good story. So that's kind of like my, you know, when I'm picking and choosing which stories go into a collection, they've got that twist at the end, and they could really, really see them being portrayed on an episode of The Twilight Zone. I think I've hit the mark I was going for.
Are we talking about old Twilight or new Twilight Zone?
You know, I love what Jordan Peele is doing with just about everything. I mean, that's what we needed. We needed that fresh voice in horror.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly does it. I love him. I do love the old Twilight Zone because they set the stage, but you know, like everything else, you know, things need to grow and things need to progress.
Was that the show that got you interested in like writing and things like that?
In ways it did. But like when I was a kid, I went to see the movie Jaws, and like immediately there were two things I wanted to do. I wanted to become a scuba diver and I wanted to write a second part to the movie. So I started writing that second part more so as a screenplay as a very young boy. And then later on in around 1989, I learned how to scuba dive.
Hmm.
Wow.
So Jaws wasn't the thing that.
Sorry.
What was that?
Go ahead, Dicey.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just curious, how many times have you scuba dived? Do you still do it as a hobby?
I haven't done it in a while. Last time was over 10 years ago. But it was, you know, I've done hundreds of dives, but it started out as doing shipwreck dives in New Jersey because there's a lot of shipwrecks. So really? I would go, yeah, we have over 3,000 shipwrecks, like within 3 miles off the coast of New Jersey. And a lot of them are German submarines from World War II, battleships that were sunk by German subs just off of our coast. Yeah, people don't realize like how close that war actually was to us. Yeah, there were German subs going up the Hudson River, actually.
Who would have known?
Yeah, wow. Yeah. But there's a lot of shipwrecks. So I really, like when I was younger and in much better shape, you know, I could do that a couple times a week. And then as I got older, it became, you know, doing it on vacation in tropical settings. And now it's a fond memory. I suppose if I had the chance, I would do it again in maybe like, you know, a resort setting or like Mexico.
A few things come to mind with that. If I'd have watched Jaws, I would not have thought, oh, you know what? I'm going to go scuba dive down where Jaws is, where the sharks are. How did you walk away from seeing Jaws? And instead of being afraid of that, you know, did you look at that as a challenge? And it's like, you know, that's what I need to do. I need to be down in there where the sharks are, where the danger is.
The danger didn't even, like, to me, that was a movie, you know, Jaws was a movie. What I identified with was Richard Dreyfuss's character, Matt Hooper, who was the oceanographer who went scuba diving and was in the cage. And while the shark was getting everybody on the boat, he was safe at the bottom of the ocean as a scuba diver. So it wasn't like, oh, my God, a shark is going to get me. It was like, that's a really cool thing to do. I really want to learn how to do that.
That's pretty awesome. You were able to like separate out like, okay, this is just a story, which is what I do with horror too, right? Like when I go see a horror movie, I never go, oh my God, the blood. Oh my God, this. I'm just like, oh, that's just movie stuff. Like it never freaks me out.
And you know, that reminds me of something I saw earlier. I saw a meme that said it was two writers, I think, or just creators in general. Put it out there. Create what it is you want to create because you never know who you're inspiring and how you're inspiring them. So, I mean, different people get different things from what they're watching, but who knew that someone was going to watch this Jaws movie and not just be entertained, but think, you know what? I identify with this character. Now I want to go learn a new skill. I want to go scuba diving. That's amazing. I think that, you know, that whole circle, how that works with putting something out there that you're inspired to put out there, and then it inspires so many other people. That is the beauty of art to me, and art in any form.
Yeah, I like that. I like to think of it that way. Mm. For me, you know, for all the kids that I was hanging out with, like we were all drawn to that aspect of the movie. So that, you know, just in that microcosm of where I grew up, and the kids I was hanging out with, like, it inspired a lot. And I imagine, like, those fingers are far reaching into everyone that it affected. You know, if you look at the movie, was that 76 or something? I think that it came out. I think I saw it, like, a year or so after it came out. And that's probably, like, the first horror movie I saw in the theaters to have such an impact on me.
Wow.
Yeah, because I like most horror movies I have had, like when HBO first came on, I begged my mother to let me watch Halloween, and that was like the first show I saw on HBO. And then I remember going to see my first R-rated movie, which was Friday the 13th, the first part. So like horror and me are very close.
So as a publisher, do you think you gravitate more towards a good story or for inspirational stuff? Because I follow you on Facebook, and I know you're personally very inspirational. But as a publisher, what would you say? How does that affect you?
Oh, well,
those stories.
You know, all those things. I'm inspired, and I gravitate to authors that actually inspire me. Before I even consider signing on or taking on another author, I have to be in love with what they do. I have to love their work. And I am drawn to atmospheric stories with tension and suspense. I'm generally not really drawn in by that jump scare or the extreme stuff. Not that that has its own place. It's just not really what draws me in. So I'm pulled in by story. I'm pulled in by voice, and I'm pulled in by atmosphere, character, and tension. And if an author can grab me with all of those and bring a fresh voice to it, it's a no-brainer for me. I'm definitely all over that.
And how many authors?
I'm sorry. I was just
going to authors. How many authors do you have now?
I'm going to have to keep. We don't do a lot. Like I keep it very limited, because you know, I don't think you know. I'm just one guy, and you know, I'm growing the business, and I don't want to overextend myself. And also, you know, like if I'm taking on too much, how could I be putting that much attention into people? So I've had a book come out with Diana Olney. I will always consider her the first addition to Last Waltz Publishing. Jack Wells was our next edition, who came out with the Monochrome Noir series. I've done work with James G. Carlson, who also owns Gloomhouse Publishing, but he will always be an honorary member of Last Waltz Publishing as well. I've done a book with Mark Towes from Australia, who is a D&T author as well as being all over the board, but he will be an honorary member. We have Heather Miller, who is a fantastic author, who came on last year with her book, Tales My Grandmother Told Me. Just this year, we've taken on three new authors, and that would be Jay Mazur, who hails from, who I believe you know, right?
Yeah.
Hails from the Great White North and is now a Texas resident. And she's got her first book of a trilogy coming out this year called The First Time I Saw Her. And it's going to be awesome. And we have Jennifer Ann Gordon, who signed on with us, who will be coming out with a collection called The Japanese Box. And we have our first young adult horror author. Not the author is a young adult, but we've got a young adult story coming out in time for Halloween, which is a young adult zombie story by Veronica Smith.
Nice.
Oh, no, Veronica too. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where we stand for this year. There's potential of one or two others authors joining us, but that's our roster in a nutshell. And you know, we like to keep it small at this point. You know, maybe that'll change in the future, but I feel like I'm doing what I can handle right now.
And I think
that's
it's good to talk about it, because there's so many writers that come to Dicey and I, how do I get started? Where do I get published? And a lot of people get going and then they get so disheartened because they get turned down and turned down and turned down. And I think what you said is important for people to understand. Not everybody's going to jive with what you've got, but you will find the person who is waiting for that. You just got to keep going. It's a numbers game.
Yeah, there's definitely, there's still quite a few indie publishers out there. And then there's, you know, you've got some bigger publishing names out there. And, I see people making posts all the time that, hey, I just landed my novel is being published with or, you know, I'm not going to name the competition, but, you know, I see it all the time. People are selling stories to anthologies. People are getting published by other publishing companies. And you know, just because Last Waltz Publishing might not be open for submissions, or if we've turned you down, it does not a reflection on your work. You know, it just means that we're not the right fit for you. And, you know, you just keep looking and you just keep plugging.
You know what? Congrats to you and your authors. But I'm going to tell you what, you said small. I was expecting you to name like three. You named a whole full house. That's big. I mean, okay, small in terms of it's not Schulster or, you know, whatever the big ones are, but that's still big. That's amazing. And this is how many years doing this?
We opened up in October of 21.
So look at that.
So we've been open 18 months. About 18. Yeah, about 18 months. So in that time, you know, some of them have been discounted books, but we're coming up on a big watermark, and I hope to do it. It's probably not going to happen this month, but I hope next month that we will have reached the 10,000 units moved.
That's amazing. Congrats to all of you.
We're hoping. I think if we counted in our Barnes & Noble sales, we're over that, but you know, our Amazon sales, we're hoping will be at the 10,000 mark by next month.
That is amazing.
You have some of your authors coming to Texas AuthorCon. We've been talking about that a lot on the show the past few episodes.
That's right.
So you want to talk about who's going to be there, so people listening want to go meet them?
Yeah. Well, I highly recommend, if you're going to be at Texas AuthorCon, you stop by the Last Waltz table, because this is, I wish I was going to be there, because that's going to be the fun table. Right now we have Jay Mazur and Heather Miller going to be working that table. We're hoping that another one of our authors from one of our anthologies, Mackenzie Hudson, is going to be there as well. It's looking really good that she's going to be there too. So essentially, you know, I mean, you've heard of Charlie's Angels, Damon's Devils should be running the table, and I will be available via like a speaker box, you know, and I'll be giving instructions from, actually I'm going to be standing back and letting the girls run the show, but yeah, we're going to have a bunch of our anthologies. Both Heather and Jay are going to have new releases for this show. Heather's going to have a new book only going to be available at this show right now. That's the only place you're going to get it. And Jay is going to be coming fresh off of the release of The First Time I Saw Her. And it's going to be exciting. So they're going to have those. I'm sending down a bunch of copies of Manxiety. I'm also sending some cool swag down there. And there's going to be copies of our anthologies that the girls will be signing. And I know it's going to be a good time. I really do wish I was going, but if my social anxiety wasn't through the roof, I would definitely be going. But I know when the women can do so much of a better job, and there's no need for me to get in the way.
Mm-hmm. And you have Manxiety. That's the cover behind you, right? Yeah.
Yes. That's from Greg Chapman. Greg Chapman has done he's done three covers for me now. Greg Chapman, definitely check Greg Chapman out. He does great work. He lives in Australia. He's an author, member of the Horror Writers Association as well. He did this cover for me. He did the cover for Arcranium, which I wrote with Mark Towes. And he is doing the covers of my upcoming series, The Ocean Ox, which will be coming out next year.
Mm. I want to hear about your writing. Tell us how all that gets started for you. And I'll let you tell the people about your life. And we don't want to just ask you all these questions, but talk to us about your inspiration.
Yeah.
You brought all this to life for yourself?
At a young age, I was always inspired by horror. I was always inspired by writing and reading. My mother read to me. My mother was a journalist. And I read I was in grade school. I read Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury. And it changed my life. The prose, the mood, the feeling that transcended from the pages of that book symbolizes for me what Halloween felt like growing up as a child. The mystery, the wonder of first discovering Halloween in autumn. I can't put it into words because that's how emotional that is for me. It's such a pivotal point, and Ray Bradbury's writing in that, like, each sentence is perfect, and that transcends into a perfect paragraph, to a perfect page, to a chapter, to a book. It's just the perfect moment in horror history, and it impacted me at just the right time, at just the right age, and I always wanted to write. And then, of course, I read everything Stephen King put out, and I was tremendously influenced by his larger works like The Stand and It and The Dark Tower, and then Robert McCammon's Swan Song and all that. So I wanted to write, and I started writing like screenplays. Like, I tried to write a second part of Jaws. I tried to write a second part of Star Wars, and then I gravitated to playing music in a band, and I was writing lyrics. So there was like this parallel that I took for years, and then I kind of fell away from it all for a while, and my life took a dark turn. And it was during that dark turn where I rediscovered the writing. And
do you want to go into that dark turn?
Yeah, so I guess that's a segue. I'm going to need a sip of water.
Understandable.
Let's get into it.
Yeah, when I was 40 years old, I got hurt on the job and I got prescribed painkillers. And it kicked off this feeling inside me like I had finally discovered the missing piece in my life. Very quickly, I became addicted to opiates. Changed me, completely changed me. Like, personality changed. Like, I was not a nice person. So, you know, I lied. I begged, borrowed, and stole. I did some horrible things. I lost my wife. I lost my house. I lost my job. I lost all. I gave it away piece by piece is what I did. I didn't lose it. I discovered heroin, and that was more important to me. So, you know, at that point, what's going on in your brain is your survival instinct is telling you that the drug is the most important thing. And, you know, you're basing all your decisions on that. I did a crime. You know, I robbed a convenience store to get the money for the drugs. And I got caught pretty quickly afterwards. And when I was in the holding cell and they're questioning me, I folded like a paper sack, and I confessed to everything. And I think I wanted to get caught for a long time because, you know, I was in this really, really bad place where, you know, I couldn't continue using anymore. And I couldn't quit. It wasn't in my power to quit. And there was a point where I tried to take my own life, which was a failed attempt, which made me feel like an even bigger failure, you know. So I confessed, and this weight was removed from my shoulders. I actually slept in the holding cell that night for like the first time in a long time. And I ended up in the county jail the next day, and I was, you know, they were throwing out very large numbers for what I did because I confessed. So they had a slam dunk. So they were throwing out, you know, 25 years, 20 years, you know. Oh, and when you're in that position, it's just like it's a waiting game. So you're waiting to try to get the best, the lowest amount of years that they're comfortable giving you, and the most amount of years that you're comfortable doing, which is crazy. I stayed in the county jail for 18 months. And when I got there, you know, I was despondent. It was the darkest. And I was, you know, I was coming off of heroin, so I was sick. My head was not, you know, I was still crazy. Although I'd been separated from the drugs, I was far from sober. And somehow I managed to get a job in the officer's dining room within like 2 weeks of working in the jail. So they put me in there, and my monkey brain is looking around, and I'm seeing fruit, and I'm seeing yeast, and I'm seeing juice, and I'm like, I've got all the ingredients to make hooch. I'm going to make it in the dishwasher, and I'm going to put a barrel in the dishwasher, and it's going to be the greatest thing, because on Christmas Eve, I'm going to bring it up to the block, and all of the guys are going to think I'm the champ, because we're going to drink in the jail. And you know, so this was still a game to me. And like, you know, the next day I got caught for making hooch in the jail cell. So I was thrown into the hall, and it was Christmas Eve, and there was like no heat, and I'm freezing, and there's like one thin sheet to keep me warm. And the only thing in that cell was a piece of paper about recovery. And I read it, and then I read it again, and I kept reading it. And you know, I was like, you know, this is it, man. You know, this is your rock bottom. I mean, if you've got a shovel, you can keep digging, but you know, I didn't have it in me. I knew I had to do something. So I signed up for whatever programs I could take in the county jail. They had AA, they had NA. It was church. I was going to three different kinds of churches while I was in the county jail, just trying to gravitate to something that was different than what I had been doing. And in one of the AA meetings, I met a guy, and you know, I said, "Do you guys ever bring in you know, sponsorship through you know, an outside source?" They're like, "You know, we've never really been asked to do that." But he's like, "Let me talk to people." And this guy named Carl talked to a guy who he sponsored named Tom. Tom agreed to come in and meet me once a week through the video conference. And Tom came in, and together we, like, you know, started talking, and then started working the 12 steps. And that was my first step into a new life.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
obviously you didn't get the 20 years. You're here.
So here's how it goes. So I spent 18 months in the county jail.
Time served?
No. Mm. And I went through the steps as much as I could in there. And I actually, I went to every meeting. I was helping other guys. I was sharing my story. And it came time for me to sign, and the lowest they were going was 12 years. So I said, all right, you know, I mean, like, you know, what am I going to do? This is out of my hands. I've done what I can do. And the lawyer says, he goes, you know, the judge says, they're going to give you 12. He goes, when you get up there at the end and you talk, he's going to reserve to write to, you know, maybe take a couple years off that. Which was a shot in the dark. So I signed the 12 years, and I got up, and I'm like, Your Honor, you know I got to do time for this. You know, I know what I did, and I can't even express the regret that I feel. And it's not regret because I got caught. The regret because now, you know, not only is that it's not really the time taken away from my life that matters, it's the time taken away from the ones I love, which, you know, they never deserve that. And there's no way I'm ever going to pay them back. I have been doing this. I've been doing that to help myself. I've been doing the steps. I've been working with these guys. And, you know, when I go to prison, which I know I'm going to, I'm going to carry that message with me. You know, and this will be, this is, you know, the point that turned my life around. And the judge looks at me. He goes, you know, he goes, I've been doing this a long time. He goes, I can tell the bullshit when I say bullshit. Yeah. Okay.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I can tell the bullshit when I see it. And he goes, I believe every word you said. He goes, unfortunately, I do have to give you time. And you know, if you can help one person while you're in prison, then maybe this will all have been worth it. Mm-hmm. And he's dropped 2 years off. He said, I'm going to give you 10 years and you have to do 8.5 of that. Mm-hmm. And I went to state prison. And did my time and did my time without a hiccup, actually, and continued to work the program. And I got a college degree while I was in prison, and I started writing again while I was in prison. That's mm-hmm. where I wrote several of the short stories out of the book I just released. And actually, it was my writing that really was like a chrysalis. It was kind of, you know, my catharsis, the tool, that creative tool is so important to have. That really gave me focus and it was so therapeutic and beneficial to the my becoming.
Mm.
Wow, that's amazing. And yeah. Look how far you've come.
Yeah.
That's just great.
Yeah, you know what? I still have friends who are in there, and I talk to them periodically. I've been out a little over 2.5 years now. I've been home. It's, you would think it, I remember it, you know, and it comes back a lot, but a lot of it gets... it's getting pushed to the side, like I'm repressing it. You know, but then there, I get hit by it all of a sudden where it's there. And it was a pivotal moment in my life. I don't, you know, if I did not get arrested, I would have been dead. Or I would have never had that awakening, and I would have missed out on the person I was meant to be.
Mm.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just wild. But everybody has a path, you know, and you embrace yours. And that's something I think a lot of the younger kids and the younger generation don't realize, that you have to learn to embrace what you've created, you know, whether it's good or bad, it's important. And also, you're living exactly what I tell people all the time. All experiences, even the bad ones, are so important for a writer, because it comes out in your writing. You are able to share a depth that other people can't, because you stared at that really black hole. You know where that is. You know what I mean?
Mm.
Yeah, you know, for me as a writer, most of what I write, there's a smidgen of truth in all of it. Sometimes it's verbatim of what I've been through. Even in Anxiety, there's four of the stories are memoirs. But most of them are based on something, you know. There's so much, you know, I could just really go in. I mean, I was hit by a car at 10 years old, and, you know, that story's in there. The visions that went through a 10-year-old's mind when he had a concussion and, you know, was healing from a broken femur in the hospital bed. That's a horror story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, definitely. There's addiction stories in the book. There's a story of men going into the halfway house when pandemic hits and closes down the halfway house. That's a page out of my life. That, like, I've been through that. You know, I feel that I have a experience that most people do not. A lot of people do, because I mean, such a great large percentage of Americans end up in the prison system or in county jail at some point, you know, and that's America. And, you know, it's something that I've got a firsthand look at as not only a prisoner, but as an author, you know, and I can tell that story from multiple perspectives. This got deep.
Yeah. Well, you know what? What I'm curious about is, did you have any haunted experiences in the jail?
That's funny, Dicey. We're like this.
Yeah. You were thinking about that, because you've heard of Lavaca Jail, and there's some other haunted jails that, you know, are not functioning anymore. But, you know, hospitals, jails, and like psych wards, like there's a bunch of places like that have a lot of haunted experiences. I was just curious if you experienced any of that during the 8.5 years you were there.
Not in the prison that I was in. The prison that I was in was, I think, built in the 80s. So it wasn't that old, but when I got transferred to a halfway house, there was some things going on there.
And
it was called Talbot Hall in Jersey City, right around Jersey City in New Jersey. Very old building, turn of the century. It used to be a shipyard in the back, and they made different parts for ships. And there were places in this building that had giant vaults put in there. And I ended up getting a job with the maintenance department. So it was a three-story building with, you know, been renovated and turned into dorms and was definitely falling apart. The maintenance department was in the basement, and being a part of the maintenance, we got a little bit more freedom than some of the guys who were not working. So we would be able to sit down in the maintenance room and drink coffee later into the evening when nobody was around. And the doors would open on their own when we were sitting in there. There was a water dispenser, you know, like the kind where you, with the big jug, and it had the tray and the hot and cold. So we'd be sitting there talking, me and this guy, Craig, and all of a sudden the tray of the water would start sliding out and sliding out until it fell onto the floor. We'd put it back and it'd do it again, and then the door would open.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did you ever get a sense that there was a message that was trying to come through, or why do you think that was happening?
I don't know. I really don't know. I talked to a man who was one of the supervisors there, who he was from Haiti, older guy. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, I've been seeing things here. He goes, yes, there are things in this building. And he goes, I will be walking up the stairs at night, and it will pass me, or it will be behind me. And I know, he goes, just don't try to interact with me. Enough said. I won't.
Yeah, say less. Yeah. Did you ever hear of any stories, like any traumatic things that happened there, like historically in the place, or like was it built on like some weird cemetery or something?
It wasn't anything like that. They did make parts for battleships during World War II, I believe. They made anchors and things like that. So I don't know if any, you know,
I mean, it was a halfway house, so people could have died in there. You know?
Well, I mean, people even died in there when I was in there. So people were always dying. This was right before COVID, this one. But, you know, there was this this drug going around called K2, which was like, they called it herbal incense or whatever. But what it was like paint and and all these chemicals sprayed on potpourri. And guys were smoking it, and they were like swimming in puddles in the shower, and like thinking they're bulls and running their heads into the wall, and like they were getting stuck. So like I saw one or two guys pass away on that. Yeah.
I laugh at inappropriate times. I am not laughing at the fact that they passed away.
No, I mean you gotta laugh at that.
It was about the K2 and all that.
Yeah, I'm glad. I'm so glad that by that time I got there, I was so removed from that. While I was there, I was actually running the Narcotics Anonymous program. So I was in that. So at night, I was actually, you know, doing the speaking, and I was sponsoring guys while I was in that halfway house. So turn of how this life turns in circles, you know.
My goodness.
Well, but I will tell you this. So when I was younger, we used to do a lot of urbex investigations, and there was an old abandoned asylum in a couple towns away from me. It was called the Overbrook, and if you go online, you can look up the Overbrook Asylum in Verona, New Jersey. And this place was still standing when I was in my 20s and 30s. And we used to go up there and we used to drink beer and have a real good time. And this was straight out of the Freddy Krueger movies. Like this, they'd been abandoned since the 60s and 70s. Huge complex of buildings. The gurneys were still left in there. The windows and doors were ripped out. There was graffiti everywhere, broken glass. And there were more than just a few stories about this place. Like, bad stuff had happened there. Oh, during the course of the time, like, over 10,000 patients died under the care of the Overbrook. It was bad. So we're up there one night, me and three other friends, and we're drinking beer. We're drinking bottled beer. And we're going to go in one of the rooms, and we're going to smoke something in one of the rooms. So we're walking down the hall. And everybody goes into the room, and I'm the last one in. I have the last beer, so I drink it. I toss it down the hall. I toss it. It doesn't break, but I hear it jangle down the hall. So we go in that room, and we smoke, and we're hanging out for a little while, and it gets dark. We had a flashlight, so we turn the flashlight on, and we're like, hey, man, it's time to go. You know, we all felt like it's time to go. I step out into the hallway and I shine my flashlight at the threshold of the door. Sitting right to the side of the door is my beer bottle that I threw down the hall, standing upside down on its rim with a puddle of beer around it. I was the last person in the room. I was the last person to throw their beer. No one left while we were there. My beer bottle came back 20 feet, turned upside down, and stayed there on its lid.
That's the ultimate do not fucking litter in my house.
All right, so yes, either that was a spirit doing that, or something worse, a person. doing that and then going off and what, waiting, watching us, you know?
Yeah,
both are terrifying. So that's called the Overbrook, and that story is a memoir, which is in Manxiety also.
The way you described it reminds me of that movie Section 8. Did you see that?
Section 8.
Section 8, you gotta watch it. If you like possession, horror type things, fucking creepy. It's great.
I'm gonna look it up. You know what streaming service it's on by any chance? Or gonna check
it out. There's so many now.
Yeah, I know. Section 8.
Session 8. It's
are you saying session, S-E-S-S-I-O-N, or yes. Section?
Session 8.
Session 8. Because it's in a psychiatric, abandoned psychiatric hospital that sounds exactly like what you described. And these guys are contractors, and they're supposed to go in and start ripping stuff out to get the building ready. And one of the guys finds old tape, like audio, of a therapy session with someone. And so you're listening to what's happening. While he's listening to that, all the shit starts happening with the other guys. People start dying. It's good. It's really good.
I'm going to check that out. I can't wait.
Now I'm going to watch it again. I love horror movies like that. I'll watch them over and over.
Damon.
So, go ahead.
You might want to go first with where I'm going to go next.
I bet we're going to the same place. I was about to ask, do we have a Mrs. Minx in the picture? What's happening with your life?
You know, this
people are seeing you and they're going, look at this handsome gentleman.
I have a girlfriend. No, Mrs. Minx. I have an ex Mrs. Minx, but I have a girl who is there, reads all my stories first, gives me the critique, and finds all those typos that I missed, and goes with me everywhere I go to sell books and helps me with all that I do. So, yeah.
Now I feel bad where I was going.
Well, not you.
I mean, it's still about horror, but, you know, from the sexual aspect. I used to work in a prison years ago, long before law school and everything. So I experienced like a different side to the, I was a counselor, case manager, and then I was a jobs coordinator. And so I had a chance to see a lot of the horror aspects that people don't usually talk about when they leave, like a lot of the rapes and a lot of
murder.
Yes, is lots of violence, especially like at night, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was wondering if you know, like, do you continue, did you do therapy or whatever? Like, how have you dealt with, I'm not asking like what personally happened to you or anything, but just the atmosphere being in that. I know it had to have some sort of effect on you in that regards too.
Yeah. And definitely did. I witnessed a lot of things while I was in there. You know, like I said, fortunately, you know, when I went through there, somehow this change in my life gave me like this shield of armor where nothing did happen to me. I also made friends with very high-ranking gang members and who saw that the genuine guy that I was and pretty much were like, you know, just mention my name, nobody's gonna mess with you. So I had some very thorough friends and still do because of
way it's a different world.
Yeah, well, you know, if you go in and you're respectful, you conduct yourself like a gentleman and are thorough with people, that goes a long way. At least where I was.
How tall are you? Are you a big guy?
No, I'm about 5'10".
Okay. Did you get buffed and muscular while you were in there? You know,
I did a lot of push-ups, but I was never the kind who could put on a lot of weight. But yeah, I'm about 240 though. You know, I do have a little muscle on me, but I also got a little fat on me too. But you know,
I mean, we don't know about that.
Yeah, but
your girl likes it, you know. It's all good. You should get more to hold on to. She can
like a teddy bear, really. Uh-huh. I did see a lot of stuff though. You know, people were killed while we were there. People overdosed a lot. That happened a lot. The rape you don't hear about as much. I'm sure it happens. I think it happens in other parts of the country a lot more than it does in the New York area. Our gang was our gang. No, I'm not a member of a gang. Our prison was pretty much, it was a heavily blood-run prison. So there wasn't a lot of that going on.
Okay.
And
yeah, it's different in each coast. It's all
But yeah, you know, I did. I definitely went for
it. It's a lot to process, and I think writing probably helped you manage some of that while you were there.
Yeah, you know, if you can get something out on paper, it some kind takes the power away from it. An emotion or whatever, you know, if you can transcend your emotions into words and then put it on paper, it's not so much eating at you, it's now paper.
Now Dicey's making me do this because she normally does these sorts of things. You are a male, you are a man, I'm sure you missed sexual activity. Did you write any fun stories for your cellmates to enjoy? Like octopus sex, or
you know what's crazy is that even when I was there, I didn't even look at girly magazines. Like,
wow. I
shut that part off. There were a lot of guys who were like, oh yeah, I'm writing this girl in the girls' prison, and we got this this sex thing going on. You know, they were writing letters back and forth, but I still I got divorced because of my addiction, and I lost my wife because of that. And I lost most of my friends and family because of that. I had still yet to come out and prove to people that I was changed and not the guy who went in. So I didn't have a girl writing me, and I didn't have anybody visiting me. I was doing it on my own, and I pushed that part to the side. Mm-hmm. And then when I got out, I made up for lost time.
You know, Chantel, when you mentioned it, I thought about the girl in Orange is the New Black and how she wrote those sexy stories for people. Yeah. Damon, I want to ask you this, though. There are some people that feel like, now, we as what we write, we know that it's cathartic, but a lot of people say that you were keeping your head in a dark space, you know, like you should be and surrounding yourself and immersing yourselves in light and positivity. And I'm going to go overboard here, but flowers and unicorn and all that light, fluffy stuff, you know, to keep yourself positive. Because if you're staying in horror and angst and demonic stuff or satanic stuff or witches and demons and dragons, then that tears your spirit down and it opens you up for all the negativity instead of giving you this light and positive stuff. What is your response to that?
You know, you can't have any light without darkness.
I
think you need a juxtaposition in your life at all times. And for me, I was devouring books while I was in prison, but I was devouring a multitude of everything I was reading. I remember reading It. I remember reading 11/22/63 while I was in there. I remember reading What the Buddha Taught. I remember The Power of Now, Moby Dick.
Of Now, I'm reading
Tolle, Eckhart Tolle.
Reading that now.
That's a deep book. But I mean, if you can, I think I was able to harness that for like a brief point. I think you probably really need to always be reading it and constantly
reading
it to really, really grasp that. But yeah, I remember, you know, one time like a guy's like, oh my God, I'm, you know, when I get out, I'm not going to be able to get a job and I'm going to get through that. I go, you know, what are you worried about? I mean, that's the future. That's not even real. You know, the future is only a possible version of now, which may not happen. So if you're worrying about something that's not going to happen, or you're worrying about something that already happened, a past version of now. You've got 1 foot in the past, 1 foot in the future, and you're pissing on today.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's
a good one.
Yeah, that doesn't mean don't plan for the future, but yeah. You know, you can't
live in the now.
Yeah, you really, you know, you get this breath.
Mm-hmm. So you wild out when you got out and made up for lost time, right? I didn't mean to overlook that, you know, when you said
I
that.
Didn't want to say I wild out. So when I was in third grade, a girl moved to town, Wendy. And you know, we were smitten, like in third grade we were smitten, but you know, she matured quicker than me. I did not. We went on our first date together for like burgers and ice cream at the local Friendlies, and wasn't until much later in life that anything ever happened with us briefly. She was either married or I was married. And then when I got out, things kind of happened. So actually seeing somebody who I had my first crush on in third grade.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's kind of another full circle of life, saying, wow,
yeah.
Yeah. Know. When you were inside, did you... I'm sorry, Chantel.
Go ahead.
When you were inside, did you know that you wanted to not only write, but to have a publishing company and actually build, building a community with like-minded authors? Did you already have that plan when you were inside?
Not at all. Not at all. I wanted to write. And I remember reading 20th Century Ghosts by Joe Hill and being so drawn by his master of the short story. I said, I want to put out a short story collection. Mm-hmm. So I just wrote short stories for the longest time. And that's what Manxiety is. Like, I just started writing those stories. I said, you know, I'm going to keep writing these short stories, and here's the master plan. Mm-hmm. But because everything was written in these little composition books and in script and very illegible, I needed to get out of prison. Needed to transfer all those things into a computer, and I needed to edit them to the best of my ability. Then I was going to start submitting them, and I was going to get my rejections, and I was going to put those like feathers in my cap and collect rejections. And then one day I was going to get that one acceptance, and that would lead to another one. And from there, I was going to start small and go to get signed to an indie publishing company, work my way up the ladder and become the next Stephen King or Joe Hill. Or you can get signed by an agent and, you know, Simon and Schuster. It was written in the stars. It was happening. You know? So I started out on that process, and I got out. And I actually got out 6 months earlier because COVID hit, and it, became quite a bad scene in the prison population. So those who were really close to getting out got 6 months locked off their sentence. So I was fortunate there. I got let out. Started the process, started editing, started putting them into a laptop, and I started submitting. And I started getting rejections. And then I got an acceptance. And that acceptance led to another. And then I entered a contest, and I won a contest for one of my stories. And I had this little book. Well, it was about 50 pages worth of a story about a strange little child called Abigail. And the story of Abigail was written in prison. And it was essentially, I was watching men from marginalized backgrounds marginalizing other men from different marginalized backgrounds. And I said, well, this is the strangest thing I've ever seen. these guys were not comfortable with any man that was trans or gay. So that was a big thing in prison. So I'm like, well, Well, that gives me an idea for a story. So I wrote a story about a strange baby who's left on a doorstep, and this baby is very different than everyone else. And she ends up changing a lot of people's lives throughout the course of the book. And so I sent out a query letter to a couple indie publishing companies, and I said, this is my story, Abigail. Please take care of Abigail, as I am no longer able to take care of her, and she needs a good home. She's a great little story, but please don't feed her milk because she's severely lactose intolerant. And I got a call back like within 2 hours saying, like, this is the best query letter I've ever seen in my life. And I sold Abigail to the first buyer.
Wow.
Unfortunately, that publishing company folded.
And I
said, well, how hard could it be? You know, I said, well, maybe I could go find another publishing company, or, you know, maybe I could just publish it myself and open my own. Like, is it that hard? Yeah, it's kind of hard, but
but you're doing it. You're doing it, and you're doing it big. Yeah.
And so I put Abigail out, and Abigail got nominated for the Spider-Punk Award and our Authors Guild Award.
Congrats. Yeah, that's amazing.
And that was the first release for Last Waltz Publishing. And so it was not even a twinkling of an idea, but you know, it's
look at that.
Necessity is the mother of invention sometimes, you know.
Yeah. I hope that someone is listening and watching, or listening or watching, and really being inspired by this story as I am. What about you, Chantel? I mean, this is like really
inspiring. I will only add, because I know we're at the end here, one of the things that I've noticed is I was urban fantasy, and then I started slowly going into horror because that's where I'm a horror. As you get, this is my station at work. So when I get new clients, they see my craziness. But I find that the fans, or the fandom of horror genre, are so accepting and so real. So whenever you start feeling any kind of anxiety about being around any kind of horror people, you're going to be around, are going to be like, what do you need? Do you need, a moment? Do you need some water? Because a lot of horror people experience the same thing you're experiencing.
Yes, that's very true.
So in this fandom, I would say you're more at home than if you were to go to like a Comic-Con convention or anything like that. Because the horror family, I mean, I find all horror family, you know, is just the most incredible people. And all the celebrities we've talked to on here that are horror based all say the same thing. So hopefully that might bring you a little peace of mind if you're ever gonna push yourself a little. Just know you're in the right realm.
Yes. You are with real people there. People who get it. People who understand, who probably face some of the same challenges.
In different ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've noticed that too, because I'm pretty open, as you can tell, pretty honest, and I speak about what I've been through on every social media I have.
Which is great. Yeah.
And people have been very supportive and nurturing about that. And I've been stepping out of my comfort zone and doing more one-day and two-day venues to go out and sell the books, and you know, pushing myself to be that social guy, and the horror community has been great. Yeah, it's been.
Well, hopefully one day we'll get to meet you in person.
Yeah, I'll be down in Texas again.
Now I know we're over time. I know we're over time, but I hope you don't mind if I ask one more question.
Sure.
What did you think of It? The movie, the Bill Skarsgård version, this remake, because I know you said you read it by Stephen King. What do you think of this reboot, It?
All right, so I will tell you this, that I just rewatched part 1 and 2 end the original miniseries last week.
Mm-hmm.
I love the new one.
Mm-hmm.
I am head over heels about the new one. Part one is the scariest movie I've ever seen in my life. And I love part two.
I'm shocked.
You know why? Because
I loved it. I watched it three times. Sucked.
That's why. it is amazing. Even part two. The characters are so good. I went back. I love Tim Curry. That original one sucks. Don't give me Jack Tripper and Harry Anderson. It wasn't even good. The kids were horrible. Tim Curry couldn't even save that movie. I'm sorry. Well, I love Tim Curry.
If you're a fan of the book, I don't think you can not like the new ones. That's how I can tell who really read the book.
It was the book, and I'm glad they didn't put the space turtle in at the end. But you know, there was too much cocaine going on with Steve at the end of that book. But you know, I mean, there's reasons why he did what he did. But yeah, everything, and I'll make it quick. But even that first scene in part two, where the two gay guys are at the carnival and the guys bully them and throw them over the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually doing a report in sociology. So that's hard to say. And I was looking up old newspaper reports, and in Bangor, Maine, that actually happened. There was hate crime in Bangor, Maine, and King took that out of the paper and wrote about it and put it in it. And it was so right out of the book, right out of his life. I'm like, I do that too. That was so good. And Bill Hader, I thought Bill Hader was spot on in his role in that. I loved it.
Me too.
Yeah.
Larry.
No, come on. I mean, Tim Curry is amazing. But yeah. Tim Curry is Frankenfurter. Pennywise, I'll take Bill Skarsgård any day.
Yes. I know I got you wound up here at the end.
Yeah, I'm almost, I won't be able to sleep.
I know I did. I couldn't let you go without asking that. Yeah.
Now I've offended people who love the first one, but.
Well, you can't spit without offending someone.
Yeah. Yeah. This one and two. By the way, Chantel, that's the other movie that I thought about needs to be playing in the background at our party. We're gonna have it.
Oh yeah.
We are gonna have Pennywise on there. He's gonna be one of those screens during.
We got so many crazy plans with Jay. We're gonna have a great time.
Yeah. Wish you here, Damon.
Best of luck with the book releases, you know.
We'll have you on camera.
That'd be great. Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much. This has been wonderful. I'm rooting for you. Keep doing what you're doing. You're an inspiration. And I hope we have a small community, but I hope as it grows, more and more people get to hear your story because it is a very inspiring one.
Thank you so much.
Tell people where they can find you, your social. Tell everybody about you.
Yeah, so there's, you know, I have two websites, so you can check me out at damonmanx.com. That's D-A-E-M-O-N, manx.com, or lastwaltzpublishing.com. I'm on all the socials, and that's all under Damon Manx, D-A-E-M-O-N-M-A-N-X. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter. I don't know what I'm doing on Twitter. I don't know. I get these random posts from Elon Musk, and I have no idea what I'm doing there, but I'm there. So,
yeah. Yo, what was going on with your voice just now? Like, did you catch that, Chantel? Like, the voice was going down there, you know? Did you catch that?
It was just a weird little fluke there.
He was giving us some ASMR at the end, you know? I'm here for it. All right. Well, thank you and good night. Thank you all for listening. Check out his books and his authors.